listening to the only daily talk show in North America covering the world of football. This is World Football Daily.
Yes! It hits the back of the net! Oh my goodness me!
The world's game.
Oh, you're beautiful! What a headshot! What a head!
Our religion.
Brilliant goal! What an equalizer!
Our passion.
Go, go, USA! Oh, it's incredible! You could not write a script like this!
World Football Daily serves up the best football talk 5 days a week.
Oh! You will never, ever see a game quite like this! Unbelievable!
Playoff spots have been booked and the Timbers, RSL, the Galaxy, Seattle, Colorado, Montreal, Houston, New England, Kansas City and New York get set for MLS playoff action this month. Suarez is sensational as the SAS team of Sturridge and Suarez dominate for Liverpool against West Bromwich Albion. And El Clasico was not as classic as we hoped. Tata Martino's Barcelona take the edge as Neymar is on song for the Catalan Giants against Los Blancos. Welcome to Monday's edition of World Football Daily. I am Oliver the Juice Wilson, bringing you the news and the important views from around the world of football. What a weekend we had. Mourinho jumping into the stands to celebrate. Suarez is sensational. The MLS playoff spots get sorted out. We had an El Clasico as well to look at. Also, AC Milan suffering a loss to Parma after going 2-0 down, getting it back to 2-2 and then suddenly falling in the final minutes as Juventus, Napoli, Lazio and Roma all continue to win in Serie A. Atletico Madrid with a fantastic 5-0 win as well in their game this weekend. There's been plenty going on. Platini today here on Monday has been talking about expanding the World Cup to 40 teams. That's what he'd like to see FIFA do to grow the stretch that football has around the world. As their biggest footballing tournament takes place. What do you think about expanding the World Cup? We've spoken about expanding Champions Leagues and Europa Leagues and the expanding of these kind of international competitions in general. And I think expanding a World Cup once again just makes it too many shoddy sides. We talk about there being too many poor sides in qualification. Now, if more of those sides are then going into the World Cup, surely it reduces the level of competition in the sport and in the tournament. We'll talk about that a little later on in the week. There's plenty to talk about, and of course we do have an El Clasico to get our teeth into today. Rafa, of course, will be joining me as always later on. We also at some point this week have to talk about FIFA and Sepp Blatter's actually, you know, positive comments talking about on the 150th anniversary of the English Premier League this weekend. Sorry, of English football, the FA this weekend. Obviously, the Premier League's only just over 20 years old. But Sepp Blatter saying that we should dock points from players and from teams, and that would be one way to start combating racism, because fans in the crowd don't want to see their teams drop points, especially for their behaviour. So Blatter with some positive points coming out this weekend, which is very surprising because normally we here at World Football Daily tend to disagree with him a lot. But we do have to break down the big game of the weekend. It, of course, was Barcelona against Real Madrid. And while I here in the UK was limited to missing the first 15 minutes of that big encounter, everybody else was able to see that. We didn't miss much. It was a drab first half. Wasn't a classic El Clasico by some people, and there's plenty to talk about from the Spanish press. And that's why today on World Football Daily, I'm delighted to say that we're being joined by Mr. Phil Ball here on the show to chat all things El Clasico and Spanish football in general. Phil, how are you doing, mate? It's a pleasure to have you back on board. It's been a long time since we last had you on.
I'm fine, thanks. Yeah, thanks for asking me. No worries. No problems.
Always a pleasure to chat with somebody as knowledgeable on Spanish football as you are, especially after a weekend that involved the biggest game in Spanish football, Barca against Real Madrid. It wasn't quite El Clasico, though, was it? It wasn't the most entertaining game that we've seen over the last few years between these two sides.
Yeah, it was a bit strange. I think they were almost trying each other out a little bit. It was two different managers. There were different personnel. You know, I think we've got used to the Mourinho Pep Tito phase. You know, where the it's pretty much the same teams and the same people facing each other with it, with a kind of violent snarl. You know, it all got a bit nasty, didn't it? And it was actually quite a pacific affair, wasn't it? Apart from the controversy over the penalty, and they were almost being nice to each other. It was quite unusual. I didn't think it was that bad a game. It wasn't a fantastic classic, but I didn't think it was a poor game. It was quite open, I thought, particularly in the second half. There were quite a lot of chances, particularly to Madrid in the second half. I thought it was quite a good game. Yeah, I agree with you. It wasn't fantastic, but I think that was one of the reasons.
There was obviously, as you mentioned, there's no Pep, no Jose, and of course maybe slightly different lineups going into this game as well, especially from Madrid. Were you surprised the lack of a front man and bringing Sergio Ramos into that defensive midfield role as well for Ancelotti?
Well, I was very surprised, yeah. I, to be honest, I thought he might try Morata out. You know, he'd been playing pretty well in the previous games, and the lack of Isco was quite surprising as well. But it would have been interesting to have, you know, given Morata a chance on the big stage, from the start. You know, you can always take him off. Benzema obviously has been having lots of problems, especially in terms of his confidence. But you know, most of the problem for Benzema is at the Bernabeu, where the crowd is kind of getting on his back. You know, he tends to play a bit better away, as you saw when he came on. But yeah, I was pretty surprised by the lineup. I think everybody was. I think that putting Gareth Bale up there was, well, you know, I suppose if you're sitting there thinking about who am I going to play, and you've got all these wonderful players at your disposal, any sort of plan that you make looks sort of feasible, doesn't it? Mm. I mean, it wasn't a particularly bad idea to put Sergio Ramos there because he is capable of destroying play. The problem is that a player like Ramos has been playing centre-half for so long that I think in those circumstances he's also expected to create, and it's just a different thing, you know, playing centre-half and playing a defensive pivot is a very different thing. And it was kind of surprising that Ancelotti got that wrong in such a big game. I think in some sort of maybe in a Spanish club match against a second division side, you can try that out. But I mean, Ramos hasn't played in that position for literally five seasons, so it was a bit strange, and it obviously didn't work. But he realised, and he changed it up in the second half.
And it was the second half where Madrid really started to come back into it as well, when they adopted that more traditional approach. Is this something that you think we're unlikely to see Ancelotti trying this again? And is it a bit risky to be trying, as you said, such a bold change in arguably one of the biggest games of the season?
I think one of the problems has always been at Madrid that managers are under pressure to play those players who've cost a lot of money. I mean, it didn't work in Isco's case, not us two, Matthew, but you know, I guess it was a sort of emblematic thing. Neymar was on for Barcelona and was one of the major figures of interest in the game. So I guess in the end, you know, Bale was vaguely fit. That's about as fit as he's been. He's still not 100%. I guess it was, you know, in a sense, it was logical to put him on. I mean, if they hadn't put him on, he'd have been criticised. It's one of those situations where you're going to get stick either for either decision, really. But so I was just a bit surprised by Ramos. I think that the Ramos situation came about because he wasn't, perhaps Ancelotti was a bit scared of throwing Ilya Aramendi into the lion's den, but I think Ilya Aramendi showed when he came on that he was perfectly capable of coping. Xabi Alonso, of course, was one game away from his comeback, and it looks like he'll be playing against Sevilla on Wednesday. Then again, would you have put Alonso in for his first game in, what, 5 months? Nah, I think he just should have put Ilya Aramendi in there and gone for it. I think I was slightly disappointed with that decision, to be honest. But hey, you know, Ancelotti's an experience. Trainer, he's an experienced guy. I mean, and Madrid didn't get stuffed, did they? In fact, I thought they were the much better side in the second half, to be absolutely honest.
And now, as you mentioned, Bale not 100% fit still, but the Spanish press have been quite ruthless with him after El Clasico. Of course, came off after about 60 minutes. And the fact that Neymar, who's kind of hogged the headlines since arriving in Spain with his impressive performances, and he obviously scored, is making it difficult for Bale and Madrid to get rid of this pressure. But unfair criticism, is it not, though, Phil, at this early stage, especially as you say, when he's not fit right now?
I think it's unfair. You know, I mean, we've all seen what Blair's capable of. We've seen what Bale's capable of in maybe a different context, but people think he can cope at that level, I suppose, because of the way he played against Inter Milan a couple of years ago. You know. But I think that he'll be fine. To be honest, I watched him quite carefully, and I didn't think he played that badly. He was more involved in the game, actually. Some of his link play was better. He was playing in an unusual position for him. I didn't think he played that badly. Obviously, he didn't have a major impact, and Neymar did, but, you know, Neymar's been up and running since pre-season, and he's proving to be a fantastic buy, really. I mean, I think people were a little bit cynical about Neymar, but I think they've changed their mind since the Confederations Cup and since the start. In fact, Messi was very quiet, wasn't he? It was really Neymar who was the most likely culprit, really, for Barcelona, and indeed he scored and played well. But I think, you know, I think Bale has to be taken sensibly. The guy's cost an awful lot of money. It's a big hoo-ha, and should Madrid have gone for him? Should they have kept Ozil? Blah, blah, blah. I think these things have to be really decided over time, but unfortunately, you know, the fast food football, as Santiago Soriano said, it's fast food football now, isn't it? And we have to have immediate results. I think he'll be fine, to be honest, Bale. I think Madrid will be fine as well. But, you know, at the moment, they are going through a bit of a transition. But I think they played pretty well in the second half. I think most of the focus was on Madrid because, you know, they've had the main personnel changes, really. I mean, Barca was pretty much the same team as last season, minus Puyol and Neymar, I guess, you know.
With Neymar coming in and obviously scoring, making a great impact, and Barca, is this going to be quite relieving for them to see them winning games now where it's not Lionel Messi doing some moment of magic to pull them out and get them out of jail on occasion? Actually, as you said, Messi and Ronaldo as well didn't feature too heavily in this game compared to other players who made more of an impact. Is that positive for Barca to show they're not relying on Messi as much anymore?
It depends on which side of the press you read, you know. So the Madrid press will seek solace in the fact that Messi wasn't playing very well and was stuck out on the right wing, where he doesn't like to be stuck out. And it's interesting, his body language changes when he's out there. You know, it was in fact Guardiola who sort of moved him inside in the end, and Rijkaard had him playing there as well. And he did take a while to actually, you know, to really become that consistent, fantastic player that we know about with Messi, because of being in that kind of media punta position. Sticking him out on the right is a bit odd. But I think also, you know, you can never really relax, can you, when Messi's around. You've got Neymar focused there on the left, and Neymar is scary for defenders as well. And so all the time when Messi does get the ball, you know, defenders all tend to sort of lose their concentration, run across to him. You're going to create space for people like Neymar. You're going to also, you know, create havoc. It didn't really happen in the game in that sense. I thought because Xavi actually wasn't playing particularly well, and I didn't think, I mean, Iniesta made the goal for Neymar, but again, Iniesta wouldn't play that well. He actually lost a couple of balls in bad positions that had set up Madrid attacks. And in fact, Barcelona lost a lot of possession in the positions in which traditionally they've won it. It was an interesting inversion of stuff. I think there are lessons to be learned for both sides, but I guess most of the attention has been on the Madrid setup, because obviously, as I said, they've got more personnel changes at the moment, and also they don't have Xabi Alonso in there. And so there was a lot to look at, wasn't there? It wasn't a great game, but there was a lot to look at, and indeed a lot to talk about.
And there will, of course, be plenty of questions continuing through the week and into the games in midweek. Let's move away from the El Clasico, Phil, because we could spend all our time on it, but there were some incredible results elsewhere. Not to mention Atletico Madrid, to keep it in the top three, at least in La Liga. Storming 5-0 win against Real Betis, and they're starting to turn some of the doubters who thought maybe they couldn't maintain this pace with Barca and Madrid, starting to turn them around slightly. A thoroughly impressive display.
Yeah, I wrote a piece on them at the start of the season, I think in the second or third week, when it was obvious that they were carrying on from last year. You know, I asked the rhetorical question, you know, and can they challenge? And I said, yes, I don't see why they can't. And Simeone was saying that the difference between, you know, his side and Barca was, and Madrid was, you know, 400 million euros, which is quite a funny joke, which is, of course, true. But you know, you look at Atletico, and really the only thing they haven't got, I suppose, in comparison to the big two, is a depth of squad. I mean, the squad's reasonably deep, but it's not like Barca and Madrid. And I guess what's happened to Atletico over the last two or three seasons is, and particularly with Simeone as a manager, is that they do tend to start very well and then they sort of fade. But hey, you know, I mean, they've won three trophies over the last two seasons. That's not bad, is it? You know, and last season winning it in the Bernabeu right at the end in the Copa del Rey. They had a magnificent season last season. If you look at their points tally, it was only really shadowed again by Barca and Madrid's achievements. And I think Madrid really did hang on to Barca's coattails for quite a long time last season. They're a better side this season. It's extraordinary that they've lost Falcao and yet they're a better team. They seem to have focused stuff around Diego Costa. He was my player of the season last season. And I got some stick on ESPN last year for actually writing that, making Costa my player of the season in La Liga. I just didn't want to say Messi and Ronaldo. I thought it's too obvious. I thought that Costa was hugely influential last season. But this season, he's really come into the spotlight. And it's interesting now that you've got Spain and Brazil both doing this tug of war over him. But he's a magnificent player. You know, you've got David Villa there. I mean, €2 million. It's ludicrous. Oliver Benji Torres, who scored after 15 seconds. He's a decent player as well, and he's another one for the future. But everywhere you look, you've got decent players at the back as well. I think they can challenge, and also because I don't think Barca are looking hugely convincing at the moment, despite their points tally, and Madrid are going through this transition. It's a good time, isn't it, to prove your credentials.
Is it without sounding too corny here, Phil, but is there a greater chemistry and understanding in this team because of the fact that they've been on this ascendancy in the last 3 years, winning trophies and being together more as a group? Do you think that that's really been a big part of this Atletico side?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it started, I think, with Simeone's arrival. But as you say, yeah, I mean, quite a few of the players that Simeone has since moulded into a unit were there before. I mean, it's not as if he's brought in that many people, actually. He's brought in two or three very important figures, and people like Costa have certainly emerged under him. But hey, you know, it's his ability, I think, you know, in a different way to Mourinho, to make a team feel that they're a unit and that everybody hates them and they come out smiling, you know. And there's a real all-for-one, one-for-all thing about Atletico. There always has been, but it hasn't always worked, you know. But under Simeone, Simeone himself has not really proved himself as a manager, as a coach before this. You know, he has done stuff over in Argentina, but it never lasted. Maybe he's learned lessons as well, you know, and this is the culmination of it. But yeah, if you look at Atletico Madrid, it's a work in progress, and it's managed to stay together. They really haven't lost many people, have they, apart from De Gea to Manchester United, and Adrian looks on the way out, but what a great player as well, you know, to not be needed in Atletico Madrid. Adrian was a star player, yeah. But now they've found alternatives, and they've got a good defence as well. I can't see them dropping out of the top four, you know, and they're doing well in the Champions League as well. It's amazing stuff.
After last year's absolute meltdown and the problems that Bielsa was having at Athletic Bilbao last year, especially with Llorente and his expected leave and departure that eventually took place at the last season, do you think there's been a real turnaround now from compared to last season and this season for Bilbao? Because it's been a solid start, not overly impressive, but a solid start to the year. And the fact that there's not too much off-the-pitch talk about them shows that everything is very much seemingly got back settled down again at the club.
Yeah. Well, Athletic never die down easily, do they? Or lie down easily. It's they very rarely have long periods in the doldrums. They have occasional ones, but you know, they're usually up there and difficult to beat. And despite the fact that I was talking to a guy today in the office who's Bilbao fan, there's quite a few where I work. They were saying that it's amazing really that they've managed to keep it going because they play every Monday. It's extraordinary the amount of Mondays they've been playing because they're not in Europe, so they tend to get shifted out to the playing tonight as well. And yet it hasn't seemed to affect them, actually. It seems to have had the opposite effect. They seem to be doing better now. And they've got, you know, they've again, like every season, because they have to really rely on the youth side, two or three decent players have come through. Mika's looking good as well, and Ibai, there's Muniain seems to have got his head back to where it should be again. This season, he had a bad season last season in terms of his performances and his attitude. They've got this new lad, Williams, coming through. Adelis isn't having to do everything. Yeah, they're sharing the goals. Iraola is excellent as ever. They seem to have solved the keeper problem again. So yeah, they're looking good. I don't think they're gonna challenge for anything that seriously. But you know, I think they're looking in a Champions League place. I'm not sure they'll get it, but they're hanging around. I think they'll be hanging around that sort of sixth, seventh position most of the season. They'll probably finish in the Europa League. Yeah, I mean they're looking good. And all with a new stadium to boot as well. It still isn't finished.
And it's a shame actually about that new stadium, because I do love, and the name completely escapes me now, but Bilbao's ground. It's absolutely fantastic.
Samames Barrier is called. Barrier means new in Basque. It's just new Samames, nothing very imaginative. But it does. It does look fantastic. And it's just that sort of bit behind the goal that's sort of spoiling the view at the moment. Mm. But I haven't been actually yet. I intend to go in the next month. But everybody who's been tells me it's pretty magnificent.
It's definitely a great cauldron of noise when Athletic get playing there. Phil, we'll leave it there for today, because we don't want to take up too much more of your time and let you get back to writing those expert pieces on all things Spanish football. But we appreciate you taking the time out to discuss El Clasico and a little bit of Spanish football with us, and we will hope that you enjoy the games coming up in midweek as well.
No worries, my pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye,
Phil.
Yeah.
Have a good day. Phil Ball joining us here on World Football Daily, talking all things Spanish football with us here on WFD. And Phil, just an expert here to discuss El Clasico. Was it the greatest one? It wasn't the greatest game, as Phil said. It was the first half wasn't desperately attractive to watch. The second half was a little bit better. There was controversy with Mascherano's shove on Cristiano Ronaldo. And, of course, a wonderful chip from Alexis Sanchez. Results as well from Spain. Malaga getting thumped by Celta Vigo on Saturday. Friday night gave us Real Vallecano losing to Valladolid 3-0. Elche lost to Granada, and Levante got 3-0 win against Espanyol. A stuttering and slightly stumbling start from Espanyol this season. Sevilla getting a 2-1 win against Osasuna. Villarreal 4-1 winners against Valencia and back up in the big time and making their voice heard, that's for sure. Sociedad with a 3-0 win against Almeria. And Atletico with the 5-0 win against Betis on Sunday. Getafe take on Racing Club Bilbao Athletic Club Bilbao tonight in a game that is going to be quite insane, actually, because Getafe have started their season well. This may be Bilbao's best start to a season, I was reading, since 1994-95. But Getafe on a very good run of form. And Bilbao have never won the Coliseum in Getafe. So it'd be interesting to see that game tonight. I'm sure Phil will be watching, and I'm sure we will as well. But a big thanks there to Phil Ball for joining us here on World Football Daily, talking all things Spanish football. And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined now, of course, as always, by the man who joins me after our guests, our wonderful guests that we have on WFD, equaled by the wonderful producer and co-host I have, who is, of course, Mr. Rafa G. Rafa Gonzalez. Man, how are you doing today, brother? How was the weekend?
Absolutely brilliant, man. And actually, there was a story over the weekend that I kind of want to touch base with you on at some point today, preferably, because let's just say my team's so bad that the past two weekends, they've avoided coming to games. And just me and this one other guy from the team, who must not be as cool as the rest of them, we check our schedule, we go to play, and they don't show up. So the last two weekends, I think they finally gave up. And I think even the league is going to, you know, see us off. Like, they're like, well, damn, should we even schedule you for the last place kind of playoff battle or no? And I was like, well, you know, I'm not going to guarantee that these guys are going to show up. Maybe you should call our captain and see what's going on, because I don't really know. And, it was kind of a bummer, but whatever. I still got to play over the weekend. And there's a guy who I play with, Juice, that I just, I am absolutely dumbfounded about. Like, this guy was so good. Anyways. There's a lot that's going on, Juice. What do you want to start with? Where do you want to go? I do want to brag a little bit. Hold on, actually. Let me just stop.
All right,
collaborate and listen.
Oh, I was really, really that
brand new edition of Fernando Torres coming through big time for Rafa. Man, did you see that?
What?
Coming through.
Fernando has apparently got this new lease of life at Chelsea. Everybody's starting to say that Torres is now kind of back to his old quality self and whatnot. I mean, do you buy Fernando being back there? You've got to give a lot of the credit to that final goal, of course, to Joe Hart and another complete mix-up by him and Nastasic. But that was Joe Hart's fault. That was completely
that
Joe Hart's fault, that one.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Have you jumped off yet?
Have I what?
Have you jumped off yet? His bandwagon. Have you jumped off yet?
Oh, I'm off it. I was off it a while ago. You know, when he stopped kind of producing great saves, you know, about a year and a half ago, and started making this kind of a regular occurrence. There's actually one of the papers in the UK here today has picked out 9 key moments of when Hart has made big failings in 2013 alone. So he is becoming more and more prone to mistakes, Big Joe Hart, and it's becoming a big, big problem for Manchester City, of course, costing them 3 points against Chelsea. Fernando, though, aren't you impressed by the way that Nando misses that first goal? Misses that first chance. Ball drops right to his feet. And normally when we've seen him miss chances like that, he generally kind of like is like, okay, that's me done. You know, this isn't going to be my day again. I'm going to sit back, sit away, and hope nobody yells anything at me too badly at halftime. And yet when he picked up the ball up on the top corner of the penalty area, just a few minutes later, and you saw him sizing up Gael Clichy, he was like, I'm going to have you. And he just destroyed him down to the byline. Pure raw pace. You know, that's something that Torres doesn't often get the chance to do. He doesn't get very often at Chelsea a chance to look at the defender facing the goal with a little bit of space. Just, you know, 1 or 2 yards. Generally, he gets the ball in the middle of the park, two defenders around him because he's playing that solo striker role, and he's generally facing backwards as well and just kind of being asked to feed the ball back to the front three of kind of Oscar, Mata, Torres. Or in this case, Schürrle. Oscar Hazard, Mata, or Schürrle in this case. And Torres this time had that bit of space, has kind of a couple of yards or so, and he's like, I'm going to do you. I'm just going to burn you. Goes straight round the outside and just plays in a wonderful ball. It was the easiest finish for Schürrle. But to have those two stark contrasting moments of Torres missing and you think, oh, he's going to drop. He's just going to lose confidence in himself already. To then answer back, any doubts that he was still kind of uncomfortable, unconfident in that game by just destroying Clichy down to the byline. I think it's something that we haven't seen with Torres at Chelsea under all the managers that who have kind of dealt with him since his Anfield days. And you don't know whether it's Mourinho or if it's just that moment that he was in or whether he's just kind of feeling like, because, you know, there's enough separation now from Drogba's, you know, his shadow isn't lingering around Stamford Bridge anymore. Lukaku's obviously out on loan. And Torres kind of knows that he is the striker at Chelsea. Demba Ba is obviously, you know, kind of second, third choice, really, when it comes to Mourinho.
So
Torres knows he's going to be playing now. And he also has kind of, he had a decent year last year. So he's got a bit of momentum coming into this season. And it's just, it's all clicking for him at this moment in time. It's a stark contrast to what we've seen in previous years.
Right. What you just said is what I kind of see, I think, is that he knows that the play has to go through him. He knows that he's an important player in this team. You know, he is, you know, I think he kind of is getting that confidence back. And that's really kind of fun and interesting to see, because like you said, when he did turn on Clichy and just like you saw it in him, you saw kind of that younger El Nino coming back and really up for it. And I mean, I was impressed. I was very impressed, because like you said, there was plenty of opportunities for him to kind of check out of the game and, you know, fumble over his own mistakes and stuff. But generally, really impressive performance. I was really excited about that. Obviously, it came through big time for me. I know the score. I'm just killing it. I mean, consistently over 100-point weekends, Juice. I'm getting so good. I'm almost thinking about breaking my rules about betting on sports, because I just, you know, generally when it comes to betting, Juice, anytime I put money on anything, I'm gonna lose. I'm like Juan Arango whenever he puts a prediction out there. You know, he's gonna be wrong.
Yeah.
So. Anyways, yeah, I was really impressed with that. I'm glad you kind of jumped off the Joe Hart bandwagon. I'm really interested to see what comes next, or whether or not, you know, City, England, you know, start to second guess him. And
well, this is what I wanted to ask you about, actually. Yeah. You know, does Pellegrini now kind of say, we got to cut our losses with this guy? You know, he's not good enough to, he's not in a right frame of mind. I know goalkeeping, obviously a confidence position. And if you take Hart out of goal, he's not going to be confident, but he's making so many rash decisions over the last 12 months. And there are one too many kind of slip ups now taking place. He's got a terrible shots to saves ratio as well. I think it's like the fourth lowest in the Premier League. This is a guy that is not playing well in goal. At what point do you draw the line? We saw Aston Villa do that when Given came out, came back from injury, wasn't doing enough, and Guzan luckily had impressed enough that Guzan was given the opportunity. And you see, you know, Shea Given wouldn't have had Villa staying up, I don't think, last season, the way he was playing, if Villa had stuck by Shea and not given Guzan the go-ahead. Do City give Joe Hart the boot? Do you think that's the right thing to do? And if City do that, surely do England have to do that as well? Because you can't have your national team keeper being dropped from his club side. If he's not good enough for his club side, surely he's not good enough to play for England.
I mean, that would be the logical conclusion. Look, I don't know the relationship between manager and Joe Hart, but if possible, you'd like to think that the manager would be able to kind of look at Joe in the eye and say, look, you need a break. You've been kind of our goalkeeper for the past however many years, nonstop. Looking at his kind of schedule of play, he's been kind of nonstop. Whether that's exhibitions in America over the summer, appearances for England in friendlies or competition, qualifying for the World Cup, just all that he's done. Perhaps, Juice, there's a mental strain kind of on the player, and a little bit of a break would do him well, like just to relax his mind, give him a couple, you know, say, take whatever time you need off. If you need, you know, do it now in the early, you know, beginning of season, where you know, we can kind of work around this, get your kind of mind right, clear your mind a little bit, come back, train hard, and when you're ready, we'll start, you know, phasing you back into, you know, into the goal, and hopefully get you back up to prime. I'm not saying that Joe Hart isn't a good keeper and he doesn't have potential. I really do believe, Juice, that he's just kind of overworked and probably mentally strained a little bit. If you think about all the play that he's had to put up with, and think about going between, you know, friendlies and summer tournaments in the States to kind of show off and have fun and this, that, and the other to real hard competition. It's just, I do think that, you know, the goalkeeping mind is a much, much kind of fickler thing than your average.
Well, everybody
footballer.
Says that to be a goalkeeper, you've got to be a little bit kind of nuts, don't you? I mean, that's...
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe he needs to kind of take some time and go nuts on his own doing something else. I don't know, Juice. I do think you can save him.
I don't think you can afford to say that to a goalkeeper. I don't think you can say, hey, you know, go and take some time out. Because there's the only one person who can play in goal. And because it is, as I say, a confidence position, you know, if you get a keeper in a bad run of form or something, it tends to just continue and continue the same way a keeper gets a good run of form going, and it just keeps running and running. So the minute that Hart is then pulled out, that's sacrificing his opportunity to start a good run of form. And if somebody else comes in and has a good run of form, look at Diego Lopez. You know, that was meant to be a temporary thing. Lopez comes in whilst Casillas is injured, but Lopez did so well that Casillas has been kept out because you have to go with a hot hand. A goalkeeper can't afford to be dropped for a couple of games because that happens, whether it's because of injury or poor performances. But if that happens and your replacement starts putting in the saves and putting in the hours and impressing, it's very, very difficult to get your job back. And so, you know, whether it's...
I'm thinking that Richard Wright or Costello...
I was going to say, Pantilimon.
I'm sorry, I just butchered that name.
Pantilimon,
you know, yeah. I think one of them can step in for any given amount of time, really needed, and fill some space. Really is what you're doing. There's enough talent on that team that they can get by, you know, their next couple matches. Without
I'm not sure
getting...
if that back four is looking steady enough though to throw in a keeper that's maybe not as commanding. I think I genuinely think that. It will be. They will go out in January and buy. I think they'll go out and they'll bring in a keeper. City. If they're going to get rid of Joe Hart, they will have Pantilimon until kind of Christmas. And I think they'll go out and they'll buy an exceptional player or bring in somebody on loan or something like that. Because I do think for City, if they're not right with Joe Hart, and then they need to make a change and bring in somebody who they can be 100% comfortable with, but also can be a big enough boost, an ego, if you will, with that back four that, you know, is still looking unsettled. Nastasic is so kind of hot and cold. De Michelis as well, I haven't been too impressed with, to be honest, this season.
Right.
You look at, you know, Kompany, who hasn't reached those heights of 2 years ago that he has done with Manchester City. He's a great defender, but he hasn't been as good as the season he won the Player of the Year.
He started this season off injured. De Michelis, I'm with you. I mean, whatever time he has gotten, he's been kind of lackluster, to say the least.
Nastasic is young. Like, he will grow into a great defender,
yeah,
I'm sure.
I think he will. And you know what? If he could put on a little bit of weight, too. I'm being serious.
Yeah.
He could put on a little bit of weight, I think he could be a really formidable defender. I'm sure he could
keep
his
pace. That's why I don't understand,
know,
like, Mika,
pace.
Put Mika Richards in at the centre-back position. We've seen him play there before, and he plays well. He knows Premier League football, and he's big enough and strong enough to be able to deal with it. I think that would help shore up the back four as well. But you know me, I'm a big fan of Mika. But, yeah, bringing out Joe Hart, I think, would be such a big sign in terms of Pellegrini and his happiness about the goalkeeper. I think if Hart did come out, it would be a very dangerous time for Joe Hart and his future at Manchester City. Elsewhere, Raf, in the Premier League, we'll keep it with Premier League for a moment. I do want to get your thoughts on El Clasico as well, because I tell you what, the Spanish papers have been vicious about Gareth Bale. But instead of talking about Bale and his disappointment in El Clasico and being outshined by Neymar, let's talk about Suarez and Sturridge. Now, I hate to say I told you so, because so many people, and I don't normally have a like bite back at the expert guests that we get on, because everybody's wrong in football, and I'm wrong from time to time. Nine times out of ten, you know, I am wrong. But a lot of people said that Sturridge and Suarez won't be able to play together, and I've featured on kind of discussion panels on different places, and when we've interviewed people here on the show talking about Suarez and Sturridge, this SAS combination, and a lot of people said, oh, I don't see them being able to play together. Rodgers will have to make a choice. It'd be one or the other. And it really isn't at this case, is it, with Liverpool beating West Brom 4-1, Suarez with a hat-trick, maybe having the limelight taken away from him slightly from Daniel Sturridge's just incredible chip. That was a thing of beauty, wasn't it? You know, I know it's late in the game, but Sturridge's finish on that was just absolutely exceptional.
We can compare that chip with Alexis's chip from El Clasico as well.
Or Danny Welbeck's at the beginning of the season against Swansea. I mean,
three
great strikes there, but we'll use that as the tenuous link into El Clasico in a minute or two. But for Suarez and Sturridge, for two players that a lot of people said wouldn't be able to play together, they do know how to play pretty great football. Suarez is obviously back, isn't he? I mean, missing the first six games of the season has done nothing, it seems, but to drive him on. And nobody's talking about that whole, I want to leave, I want to go to Real Madrid debacle that was taking place, you know, weeks before the start of the season. So, is it all forgiven now, do you think, for Liverpool? I mean, he is putting in the effort. You can't say he's not scoring great goals, because especially that first one, just the close control as he weaved through the West Brom back four and tucked it away. Just beautiful, beautiful play from the Uruguayan. Is it all loved up again between Suarez and Liverpool?
I think it probably was two games ago when you know this form was being found. Look, you can't tell me, Juice, I told you so. Because if you remember, I told you on Friday that Liverpool were going to walk all over this match. I think my prediction was 3-1, and I was slightly off. But I think that partnership alone is going to be what keeps them up. And if one of them gets injured, and I'm expecting, Sturridge. No.
Suarez?
Sturridge. Sorry. I expect him to get injured. And that's what's going to kind of...
Why?
I just do. I feel him a little more frail or something. A little less used to the bumping around that goes up top. And generally, Just a little bit younger, a little more green behind the ears, perhaps, than Suarez is up top, and that's what's gonna, you know, potentially drag Liverpool down from their little perch right now. But I'm with you. I do think that this pairing is incredible for Liverpool, and Rodgers is gonna ride it as far as he possibly can.
Do you generally think they are title contenders? I mean, when Lucas Levy is in there, obviously he's a great holding midfielder. They've switched around. They're sticking with this two up front, Liverpool, as opposed to what most teams are doing in the Premier League of having one and then three in midfield. But they're keeping that three midfielders. I mean, you look at it at the moment, it's like three centre-backs that line up on the weekend against West Brom, with Gerrard and Henderson and Lucas Levy in the middle of the park, with Glenn Johnson and Ali Sissoko playing those kind of wing-back roles that we've seen, especially a side like Juventus use so well in their kind of 3-5-2 formation. It's very continental. It's a side, something that we've seen Premier League sides kind of try with on occasion and not maybe pull it off as well as others. But for Liverpool, it is really nice. Do you think it's problems for them when they when Coutinho, for instance, gets back and gets fit, it's finding a place for him in the side? And do you think, Raf, that they can continue and be a title challenger?
No, and that's what I'm saying. I think there's a little too much weight that's going to be put up on the shoulders of those two. And whatever happens, I do think something's going to happen. That's going to put all the way back on Suarez, and that's where he's going to feel that pressure, potentially, you know, explode himself. And that's essentially what makes them, you know, not title contenders, in my opinion. I think there is a little too much, the writing on too much of a knife edge, maybe. Like, there's not enough backup. You know, like when you look at Chelsea, they're just deep and deep beyond. Deep, you know, like they go for days. The talent that's on that bench, really, the talent that's loaned out, obviously. Like, look at Lukaku. It's insane, man. So that's why I think that really, you know, Liverpool, however nice their starting lineup is, however nice their starting 11 is, it doesn't go much deeper beyond that. And that's why they're not title contenders. For me.
And similarly, maybe some people saying that with Arsenal as well. They continued their run with the 2-0 win against Crystal Palace. Palace, very unlucky, though. I watched the first hour of that game and really was. They fought so hard, Palace. I was kind of disappointed that they weren't able to get a result out of that. Arsenal, of course, with the win, Arteta with the penalty and getting sent off. There were a number of dodgy decisions kind of thing, Raf. We had, obviously, the Mascherano shove on Cristiano Ronaldo in El Clasico and Mikel Arteta being sent off for minimal kind of shove on Šemak, but Šemak was the wrong side of the Arsenal player and Arteta was the last man. But surely if we're looking at consistency across Europe with refereeing, I guess, if Arteta's is a free kick and obviously a sending off of being the last man, Mascherano's shove on Cristiano Ronaldo in El Clasico, that's a penalty, surely, for Madrid. That's a game-changing penalty decision being made there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Juice, like, it really does. It sucks when we have to talk about this because, you never want to reference refereeing, I guess, you know, in a match of that, you know, kind of caliber when you're talking about El Clasico. I mean, I could really care less about Arsenal and Crystal Palace, to be honest. But I get it that ultimately it's also a Premier League match, which, you know, the money that rides on each game, really, when you think about it, is immense. So. Obviously, there is a lot more that rides on it, and don't take my kind of personal bias against Arsenal, and who cares about Crystal Palace, really. But no, like when it does come down to El Clasico like that, you're right. That is a game changing moment, and ultimately, it's what leads to like papers kind of talking about, you know, oh, you know, what was this referee bought? Do referees favor, you know, Barcelona now, or you know what? What is wrong with refereeing, or what is wrong with the decision making at the refereeing level? And that's really kind of unfortunate, because you'd like to kind of think that with all that talent on the field, that they could play themselves to an entertaining game for the public.
Well,
but
it wasn't really, though, was it?
No.
Obviously, we were chatting about it earlier in the show. It wasn't the most classic El Clasico. You know, the first half especially was pretty dire. Neymar scores with a slightly lucky break, obviously.
I meant to ask you, Juice. Did you or did you not miss that goal due to the coverage that was going on in the UK where
We saw it. It was about 3 minutes after the coverage had started. So I actually put
That's one way to start the game then for you. If you think about it.
You kind of sit there and suddenly, boom, we go into it. But from the sounds of it,
we didn't
really miss much, though, in that opening 15 minutes. Wasn't it weird as well that first time, really, no Messi and no Ronaldo really stepping up in this game? Yeah. You know, Ronaldo gets budged down by Mascherano, but neither of those two really hogged the headlines. I thought Xavi played well. Obviously, Sanchez with that delightful chip to make it 2-0. Neymar with his goal, and Neymar looked like a tricky customer. And surprising as well, Ancelotti going without Benzema to start the game, playing without a proper front man, the false number 9, if you will, from Madrid being played, and Gareth Bale looking very uncomfortable on that pitch that night.
True. It was almost like Ancelotti was trying to give Barcelona a taste of their own medicine or something, but no, it did not work out for me. And you'd like to think that the kind of, I don't know, I get that generally Benzema is a very graceful athlete, but whenever I think of him, you know, he's kind of big, a little bit stocky. Like, you know, I just think of him bumbling around, you know, up top. But you know, I think he could have done a lot to get the attention of some of that back line and kind of open up space for Real Madrid, potentially even Gareth Bale, which would have really kind of opened up the game a lot more.
Well, you just wouldn't have started Bale, would you? I mean, considering if you put Benzema in, then you'd start with that Cristiano Ronaldo and Di Maria combo kind of just off him. I was amazed that when the news came through that Bale would be starting, and not only that, that they wouldn't be playing without a main striker. When you consider how, you know, this Barca defence has played well, but it's still not a rock-solid Barca defence. You know, it's gone is the kind of the solidarity that Puyol used to bring a few years back in his slightly younger days, if you will. Obviously, Mascherano, I don't think you can ever consider a rock at the back. And Dani Alves still likes to push on, and maybe sometimes there's the opportunity to be kind of leaving his back four or the rest of his back four hanging slightly. So I was amazed they didn't stick with a main striker, and a little odd how Sergio Ramos came into that holding midfield role alongside Modric and Khedira. It was a very peculiar starting lineup for me from Madrid, as we said earlier. A little odd for me. And Barca were the better side. It has to be said. Do you think they're missing Xavi Alonso at all? I mean, obviously, he's a wonderful distributor of the ball, Xabi Alonso. Obviously, getting on a bit.
Down, yeah, shuts down play in the midfield and generally is a great general, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I would rather have Xabi in there or Alonso in there than Modric, for sure.
Well, it's quite funny because everybody's now in Spain, a lot of the Spanish press berating Bale, saying that Madrid play better when Bale isn't in the squad. He actually hinders the side. He's bumbling on the ball, etc., etc. Very similar to the criticism that Modric received when he joined Madrid, was given the worst signing of the season award alongside Alex Song at Barca, and then give it, you know, a few more months and suddenly has that great game against Manchester United, and now, you know, everybody seems to be a big fan of Luka Modric up in Madrid. You know, it's really jumping on his case far too quickly for Gareth Bale. Sure. We said there'd be a time of adjustment, but you put an £86 million price tag on somebody and it really does make it difficult to shake that kind of hysteria and attraction around you, especially when there's a guy who your club who bought you for £86 million tried to buy. He went to your rivals for £46 million and he's taking La Liga kind of by storm straight away in his first season. Yet he was the one that people said is too small, isn't stocky or powerful enough to make a great impact immediately, while Bale was this kind of, you know, Champions League tested, wonderful Premier League dominant player. And Neymar's just stealing all the headlines at the moment in Spain and making it very difficult for Gareth Bale. Talking of which, fantastic result in terms of stealing headlines for Atletico Madrid. 4 goals in the second half against Real Betis.
Look, yeah, I'm glad you brought this up, Juice, and I want to kind of cut in a second here. Am I wrong to kind of dismiss Atletico and think that, you know what, these guys, they just don't have a chance? A good friend of ours, Gio, kind of constantly tells me, he's a huge Atleti fan, and he keeps telling me, man, they've got it, they can do a lot, they have a lot of talent, they're going to go deep, they're going to do all this stuff, I just shrug it off, and I admit, they're a very talented squad, even though they lost Falcao, they're a very, very talented squad, but, I just didn't see them responding well after that loss, and they have obviously kind of seamlessly transitioned through that and seem to kind of just quietly gathering momentum all over the place. Am I wrong to discredit them? Are they gonna crumble? What's the real story you think behind Atletico?
The real story is obviously Courtois is an incredible keeper who's helping a lot. I think there's a great team solidarity in there. I think there are a number of players who are attracting a lot of attention. I think that will be the turning point for them in January. If they can keep hold of Coke, if they can keep hold of Diego Costa, Gordon Miranda have produced this fantastic centre-back partnership on occasion this season. If they can keep hold of these players... then I think Atletico are a shout for being able to at least keep pressure on Barca and Madrid this season. You know, it's not as deep a squad as the other two big boys in Spain right now, but you can't argue with how they've started the season. The kind of the league table says it all for themselves. They've conceded the fewest number of goals joint with Barca, just 7 in the opening 10 games of the year, and they've only scored 4 less than Barca as well. They're a point off. This is a side that started well, is brimming with confidence. And Simeone, as we've heard before on the show, believes that his side can maintain and stay with these guys. He genuinely thinks and is putting that belief into them. And part of the big test for them is whether they can continue to believe that if they go through a rocky patch or not. I think January, as I say, will be a telling time for them.
I was going to say, I think the big test personally for me is whether or not they can take points off of Real Madrid and Barcelona. They've showed that against Real Madrid. If they can do it against Barcelona, I mean, that's when you really start to think that there's chance and there's possibility. Because really, those two just don't drop points. They don't. I kind of wanted to bring this up. If there was only a legitimate kind of fourth team in La Liga, it would just make it that much more interesting, because then there's really the opportunity. If there's 4 teams that can legitimately take points off each other and really kind of make a challenge for the title, it just makes it so much more interesting than a 1-2 kind of battle. And then it's just you kind of look for just 2 games out of season when they play each other, really. I would really love it if there's a 4th team that, much like an Atletico Madrid, that is challenging and potentially taking points from these 2 top dogs, because then it would take that kind of title of those top 2 and really make it that much more interesting in La Liga for me personally.
It's a shame that Valencia do have kind of their money struggles and their financial troubles at the moment, because that would be the side that you would hope would be able to fill that void, or maybe even looking back a few years or whatever, you look at Villarreal or even Betis, and Villarreal, of course, started extremely well this season.
It would have been sweet to see Malaga stick together and figure something out. What are you going
to
say, man?
And they took an absolute battering as well on Saturday, a 5-0 loss to Celta Vigo at home for Malaga. France produced a couple of surprises as well, with... Saint-Étienne coming and beating, drawing with PSG 2-2. And Germany as well with some great results. Dortmund with a fantastic 3-1 win away against Schalke. That was actually quite a big test for them. And passing it with flying colours. While Munich just getting past Hertha Berlin with a 3-2 win. Wasn't a comfortable game for them at all. Raf, before we go, quickly, Major League Soccer, the final weekend of the season, all done and dusted. And you have to say... That Camilo Sanvezo at the Vancouver Whitecaps putting on a stellar performance. Getting his hat-trick obviously means he wins the Golden Boot outright. But there was a man who was challenging for it at the end of the season, Mike McGee. His side getting pretty pasted by the New York Red Bulls. Chicago Fire miss out on the playoffs. I mean, we've spoken to Mike on the show this season, and we've been impressed about how immediately he just took to Chicago Fire and was banging goals in left, right and centre straight from the get-go. I think I personally am a little bit gutted for him that he's not been able to, the Fire haven't made the playoffs, and in general haven't made the playoffs as well, because it's been an entertaining sight to watch in Major League Soccer this year.
I agree with you. And it's not just because of my bias, being friends or whatever, or having Mike McGee's phone number in my phone. I mean, really, I have plenty of players' phone numbers in my phone that I just put in there because I like to kind of look at them and be like, yeah, that's a professional player. But no, in all honesty, I do kind of, I'm very friendly juice with a lot of these clubs. And so I was kind of pulling for Chicago. They were making a brave fight towards the end. And I was kind of hoping to see them, just give us something, get back into the playoffs, and potentially, just make things interesting. I think they can make things interesting. But I don't know there's too many teams really, Juice, and there's too many spots.
What, for the playoff spots, you mean?
Yeah. So, I guess somebody has to stay home, and if you're not good enough to get into the playoffs,
you're probably not going to win a major league title.
Yeah, you're just probably not. You're probably not good enough to really keep things interesting, I guess, and cause a stir and raise that competition.
Well, the Red Bulls able to shake the curse that many felt kind of surrounded them by winning the Sporters Shield. They got a win 5-2 against the Chicago Fire, going through to the Eastern Conference playoffs along with the Red Bulls. SKC, the New England Revolution. Carl McCarthy will be happy about that, I'm sure. They got a 1-0 win against Columbus. The Dynamo and the Montreal Impact beating the Chicago Fire on goal difference to take that final playoff spot. In the West, the LA Galaxy drawing with the Seattle Sounders. Clint Dempsey gets his first goal for the Sounders. Amazed that Dempsey, after his lash out in last weekend's fixture, getting away with nothing. No suspension, but no fine or anything like that. Not even a slap on the wrist. Dempsey, who quite obviously kicked out on a player during Seattle's fixture last weekend, escaping any sort of retroactive punishment from Major League Soccer. He scored this weekend, as I say, the celebration pointing to his watch on his wrist, if you will, saying it's about time I did this. And I think everybody agreed with that. The Galaxy should have won that. Omar Gonzalez having a ball cleared after it crossed the line, well over the line as well. Goal line technology in Major League Soccer, that's what we want next. The Portland Timbers finishing off their season with a big win over Chivas USA, and they go through as top of the Western Conference, along with RSL.
That's just laughable. That's laughable. The whole Chivas thing, I just...
Bless you.
Oh, man.
The Timbers go through top with RSL, the LA Galaxy, the Seattle Sounders, and the Colorado Rapids, who took that pasting on the weekend as well. The Rapids, I don't see having a very long and profitable future in the MLS Cup playoffs. We're going to leave it at that for today.
No, watch out. Watch out, Juice, because I have a feeling that they might make it past their first round and be a surprise.
You reckon? No, I'm not seeing that. I'm not seeing that. Let's leave it at that for today, man. So a big thank you to Raf, as always. A big thanks to Phil Ball for joining us on the show as well. And a big thanks to you guys for catching up with us on Monday's edition of the show. There's so much to talk about this week. We've got Italian Serie A. We've also got La Liga in midweek as well. And, of course, we've got League Cup action too. All of that to come in this week. But for now, take care. Enjoy the football tonight if you can find some. We'll see you in 7 months. Have a good one.